afternoon, and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, an eclectic mix for you. We'll have a conversation with composer-pianist Jake Heggie, who will be performing later this week with Carol Wincents, with singer-entertainer Clint Holmes, who is appearing at the Raz Room, and with Renette Senham, who is in town for her one-woman show about her wanderings in the wilderness of Alaska. Stay with us. Mezzo-soprano Zheng Chao singing music of Jake Heggie, The Deepest Desire, an excerpt from his Four Meditations on Love. He's my next guest here on KLW, whose music and accompanying skills will be featured this coming Monday at the Music at Meyer series at Temple Emmanuel here in San Francisco, in a program featuring flutist Carol Wincents with mezzo-soprano Quinn Middleman. For Jake Heggie's works, The Deepest Desire, Four Meditations on Love. Also on Monday's program, Heggie's Fury of Light, a work written in 2009 for Wincents, who will be additionally performing music of Johann Sebastian Bach, Ernest Bloch, Claude Debussy, Edgard Varèse, and Joan Tower. Recent notches on Jake Heggie's musical belt include composing the recent Moby Dick for the San Francisco Opera, an institution for which he also created the opera Dead Man Walking, with a libretto by Terrence McNally. Jake, welcome back to KLW.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, we could easily spend a full hour just talking about some of your terrific music and projects. So, at the outset, since you make your home here in San Francisco, let me invite you back right now.
Thank you.
Before we even get started.
Be happy to come back anytime.
Super.
Yeah.
You've had the good fortune to work with some of the most amazing vocal and instrumental artists of our time, including Renee Fleming, Audra McDonald, and most importantly, Frederica von Stade.
Yes, our dear Flicka.
On the vocal front, who was an early champion and remains an important champion of your works.
I'm not done with her yet.
Tell us, she can't
get rid of me that easily.
Tell us about your initial association with Flicka.
I actually met Flicka when I was living in Los Angeles before I moved to San Francisco, and I was running a small series there. And I really wanted her to be part of that series, and so we met and got along really well. And then I left, and a few years later, I got a job at the San Francisco Opera in the PR marketing department. And the production that was going on at that time was Conrad Sousa's Dangerous Liaisons. And Flicka was one of the stars, along with Renee Fleming, Thomas Hampson. And so I was doing PR for it. And so we reconnected and we became friends. And she singularly was the one who I had not written for about 5 years. And listening to her perform, watching her on the stage, seeing how she treated people so beautifully and was so generous, she made me want to write music again and write music for her. So I wrote some folk song arrangements, and I gave them to her for opening night, in which she accepted with a look of terror in her eyes. You know, oh, goody, the PR guy writes music. Anyway, she said, well, you know, I'm going to come in early the next time and let's read through them. And we did. And I thought, it's never going to get better than this. And then she asked me to play a concert with her, asked me to write more music for her. And it went from there. And then before I knew it, she was talking to a lot of different people, including Lotfi Mansouri, who was the general director of the opera then. And he invited me to write an opera.
I think it's worthy of a revival or a refilming of My Friend Flicka,
yeah, exactly.
With a totally different context.
Exactly. Well, she's a great friend to so many young artists throughout the world, and certainly is a champion of them in the Bay Area. Her work over in Oakland with the Young Musicians Program, with St. Martin de Porres, that school, and with, you know, so many young people all over. She's been a real inspiration. I mean, she has inspired, among many other people, me to really make it a point to work with young people and to incorporate them into the work that I do. Hence, actually, the participation of Quinn Middleman, this wonderful young mezzo. When Carol Wensense and I were putting this program together, she really wanted to do The Deepest Desire, which we had performed several times together back east. And I had recently been an artist in residence at USC. I did a short residency there, and I heard Quinn sing a couple of movements of The Deepest Desire and was just knocked out. She's only, I think, 20 years old, and she's a double major in voice and oboe. She's incredibly gifted, and she actually reminded me of Susan Graham, who I wrote The Deepest Desire for. And so I said, well, let's invite her up to be part of the program. And so really there is a direct connection between Flicka's inspiration about giving young people opportunities. And that's something I believe in enormously. And Quinn is just, she's so excited. And I'm picking her up at the airport tonight. And she's just a knockout performer.
Well, the Music Admirers is a nice space for performing.
Yes.
Nice there. Now, it seems like a lot of your music is text driven, not only in song, but in opera.
Yes.
I mentioned Dead Man Walking, which was inspired by the work of Sister Helen Prejean, mm-hmm. which is also the inspiration for The Deepest Desire,
yes.
which you mentioned you wrote in 2002.
Yeah.
So what is it about that story, obviously, that you've spent a lot of time with? Spent a lot of time with Helen Prejean's story.
Well, she's one of the most inspirational people on the planet. I mean, the way I look at it, I never had a chance to meet Gandhi or Martin Luther King or one of those transformative figures, but I feel like there's that kind of light and spirit about her. She's just an extraordinary person, real down to earth, real, you know, friendly, easy to talk to, and also tells stories about these very human experiences that she observes and participates in. And so when we wrote the opera Dead Man Walking, operas have to be about action. Things have to unfold. There has to be conflict resolution, etc. There has to be a sense of redemption at the end for it to really work. And so we were able to tell her physical journey. And it was one day when I said to her, you know, we've spent so much time talking about your physical journey to this. What about your own internal journey on this path? You know, what was that like? And she said, well, Jake, I do a very poor Helen Prejean imitation, but I can't help it. She said, Jake, she goes, I had to go to the deepest waters of my being and find out what the deepest desire of my heart was before I went down that path. And I thought, wow, the deepest desire. I said, would you write that down for me? And could I set that? And she was thrilled to write it down. And so songs can be more introspective and more reflective about personal experiences, spiritual, emotional transformations. And so that's what the song cycle traces, is the internal journey that she went on. The songs have been done a lot. They've been recorded several times. Joyce DiDonato recently recorded them with the Kansas City Symphony, and that recording has been nominated for a Grammy.
Congratulations.
So, thanks. Yeah. So, I mean, it's proved to be a very meaningful cycle to a lot of people.
Its first performance was in Vail, Colorado, with you mentioned Susan Graham, mm-hmm. As mezzo-soprano, flutist Eugenia Zuckerman, who mm-hmm. we just heard on this recording, with Zheng Chao as the singer. It's going to be performed this coming Monday, once again, as part of the Music Admire series. Let's hear a little bit more of that mm-hmm. very special work. Tell us about the movement we're going to hear.
You're going to hear the funny movement in it, where Helen was still told me a story where she was teaching fourth grade religion class, and she was still wearing the full habit. This was before Vatican II. And while she was teaching, she accidentally got too close to a candle and literally caught on fire.
Oh, my gosh.
So this
the flaming
movement is
nun.
Called,
so does it...
I Catch on Fire is what this is called.
Okay. Music from The Deepest Desire by Jake Heggie. That's an excerpt from The Deepest Desire, Four Meditations on Love. You heard Zheng Chao, mezzo-soprano, with Eugenia Zuckerman at the flute and Jake Heggie on the piano. Eugenia and Jake performed the world premiere of this work in Vail, Colorado in 2002. It can be heard this coming Monday in its entirety with Jake once again at the piano, the great flutist Carol Winsense, and Quinn Middleman, mezzo-soprano, performing The Deepest Desire, Four Meditations on Love. It's music that's inspired by and with texts by Sister Helen Prejean. Jake, that's some really lovely...
Thank
lovely
you. Writing. It was actually that piece and Zheng that brought me and Carol Winsense together in the first place, because we were supposed to perform the piece for a big party about the release of this CD, and Zheng suddenly wasn't able to sing at the last minute, so Carol and I had to scramble and rearrange things and make it work, and then she asked me to write something for her, and that turned out to be Fury of Light for her 40th anniversary season a couple of years ago.
Which is also on Monday's program, and also inspired by a poem.
Yeah. Well, you know, as you said, I'm very married to words and the spirit actually behind the words, and so this is based on a Mary Oliver poem called Sunrise that I just adore, and it's a line, Fury of Light is a line from that poem, and it seemed particularly appropriate for a flute player because one of the lines also is, what is the name of this breath I would take over and over for each one of us? Call it whatever you will. It is happiness. Another way of that. Another way to enter fire.
So let's talk about, you know, obviously you're inspired by these literary works. Mm-hmm. I mean, from the large scale, Moby Dick, to the small, the poems, to just writings, as in Prejean stuff. Are you thinking that way when you're working in a melodic sense? Because your music is so beautifully melodious. Are you thinking of words as you're composing these melodies, or are you divorcing yourself of that?
No. The words are always there. But like I said, I think what it is more than anything is the spirit behind the words. The actual words will give me a shape, a line, a kind of a sense of rhythm, because I want the words to be understandable. But even more than that, there's something that was behind, there's a spirit that was behind those words when the writer put them on the paper, right? There's something that they were feeling moved by, an event, a transformation, an occasion that inspired them to write words. And it's, I try to go back to that spirit and find out what my musical response is to that. And then that married with the words that already exist, that's how that all evolves. I really don't know where it comes from or how you do it. I just sit there in my studio and trust. Good. I try to just listen.
Good for you, because I don't have an original bone in my body, because give me some music on the page, I'll do whatever you want, but I don't have anything floating around in there that I need to write down.
I just feel like it really is there. It's like these vibrations that exist that you tap into, and if the vibration is right, somehow it resonates as truthful. But performers inspire me, the words inspire me, events inspire me. So great performers, too, make me hungry to find the material that sort of inhabit the vibration that will be meaningful to them. And Carol is one of those artists. I just think she's really one of the great artists I've ever worked with. And there's something very vocal about her sound. And she also, which is very unusual for an instrumentalist, she always asks, we discuss whenever we're doing a piece, she'll say, tell me what this piece is about. So she's interested in the story that she's telling too, anytime she's doing a piece. And I sometimes find that very rare. It's not rare with singers, but it is rare with instrumentalists. And we just get along very, very well. And I love making music with her.
That's composer Jake Heggie with me here on Open Air. I'm your host, David LaTulieb. Jake Heggie appearing this coming Monday with flutist Carol Winsence and soprano Quinn Middleman, not only in his own works, The Deepest Desire, Four Meditations on Love, and Fury of Light. The program also includes, with Jake at the piano, music of Ernest Bloch, Johann Sebastian Bach, and Francis Poulenc, his Sonata for Flute and Piano. One of my favorite all-time works for flute and piano.
Absolutely.
Jake, thanks so much for taking a little time with us today.
Great pleasure to be here, David.
And
thank
like
you.
I said, we're going to have you back soon.
Okay.
Here is Carol Winsence at the piano with pianist, I'm sorry, Carol Winsence as flutist with pianist András Schiff in the third movement finale of that work. And as a flutist myself, it's as much fun to play as I hope as it is to hear. Music of Francis Poulenc, his Sonata for Flute and Piano. Thank you. That's flutist Carol Winsence performing with pianist Andras Schiff from that excerpt from Poulenc's Sonata for Flute and Piano. You can hear that work in its entirety this coming Monday, January 28th, at a 7:30 performance of the Music at Meyer series that continues at Temple Emmanuel, 2 Lake Street at Arguello here in San Francisco. Jake Heggie will be at the piano performing some of his own works, which include The Deepest Desire, 4 Meditations on Love, text inspired by Sister Helen Prejean, and Fury of Light, a work commissioned for Carol Winsence to celebrate her Ruby anniversary. This work was inspired by the poem Mary Oliver wrote called Sunrise, Fury of Light of Jake Heggie. Also on that program, Johann Sebastian Bach's Sonata in B Minor for flute, and Ernest Bloch's Suite Modale for flute and piano, Claude Debussy's Syrinx, Joan Tower's Valentine Trills, Valentine's Day is coming, folks, and Edgard Varese's Density 21.5, a work for solo flute, Density 21.5, referring to the density of platinum. Varese wrote that work as a test piece to test the limits of a brand new platinum flute. That program, once again, Monday, January 28th at 7:30. For information and tickets, visit emmanuelsf.org. That's emmanuelsf.org. Or you can call their ticket hotline, 800-838-3006. Good afternoon. I'm David LaTulip. You're listening to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of some things culturally considered, given our time frame here. Still to come, a talk with Clint Holmes, who's performing at the Raz Room. And my next guest, playwright, performer, and San Francisco native Renette Senham, is aptly described as a Renaissance woman. She has commercial fished in the Alaskan Gulf, trained Iditarod sled dogs, founded and organized the American Women's Transantarctic Expedition. She's a world traveler and a writer. She makes her home in Northern California, where she has been involved in local politics as a city councilwoman, a former mayor of Nevada City. She's also a green pioneer of the 21st century, and I believe you've given a TED Talk as well. Now, Renette, you've traveled throughout 50 countries, climbed many mountains, and the first woman to cross Alaska solo on skis. Well, I'm glad you could find a place for the sled dogs to park here at KLW.
Yeah, they were excited to be here. Thank you, David.
Sure. Well, your love of Alaska is the reason that you're back in town. It's for a special one performance only of your one-woman show called Alaska Revisited, which recounts your journey over 1,500 miles of Alaska wilderness as a 27-year-old searching for some of life's answers. It's at 3 p.m., this one performance only, this Saturday at the Delancey Street Foundation Screening Room, and I'm so pleased that you are taking some time to tell us about this.
Thank you, David. Thank you. Yes, it's actually it is a show that I've been doing for almost 20 years throughout the West Coast and in Europe and so on, but I have never done the performance in San Francisco before. And interestingly enough, San Francisco and an iconic figure actually plays a significant part in this story, a twist of fate, as a matter of fact. So it's really quite suiting that I actually finally give the show here.
Well, how did this personal adventure evolve into a performance piece?
Well, unlike a lot of adventures, I actually have a background in theater. We had a theater company up in Nevada City called Foothill Theater Company, and then I spent 8 years actually also in Los Angeles as a screenwriter and learning about film, every aspect from pre-production to post-production. But originally, the reason why I did the show, and I thought I was going to do the show maybe 2 or 3 times at the most, was I was trying to raise money so I could go back up to Alaska to retrieve the sled dog I had traveled across Alaska with. He was in Athabascan native village where I had left in a canoe that I had built. So
Hold it. A canoe you had. Let's back up for a moment, huh?
Yeah. So that's how the show came about, and the demand for it has continued. I mean, every year I have people saying, when are you going to do the show again? I want to show my children, or I want to show my parents, and out of sheer guilt, I continue to do it, you know, every year, every 2 years.
All right, well, let's back up to how did you build a canoe, and of what?
Well, to kind of give you the scenario, I had skied down the frozen Yukon River starting on the Alaskan-Canadian border, and it was about 55 below, and a couple hundred miles into the trip, I got this dog named Diamond, a sled dog.
I'm sorry. We need to slow down a little bit. 55 below, skiing down the Yukon. Okay, yeah. No ski lifts, no hot chocolate waiting for you at the bottom.
No, just me and the sled. And originally I was to do this journey with two dogs. I was going to ski journey across Alaska. And ski journeying is where you harness, you know, a dog or two around your waist and they help you pull your sled. And 5 days before I was to leave, the gentleman who owned these dogs, along with 50 other dogs, he was an Iditarod sled dog racer. He said, you know, I don't think you're going to make it across Alaska. I think you're going to die before you make the first 100 miles. And to ensure I would, he took the two dogs away thinking that would stop me. What's going to help me pull my sled? And ultimately, I watched him walk away with the two dogs. And by that time, I'd been through so much just to even get to that point that I just yelled at him, I'll pull the sled myself. And 5 days later at 55 below, I was pulling a 160-pound sled, you know, down the frozen Yukon River at 55 below. And 200 miles into the trip, I knew that cold was extraordinarily difficult to deal with, but it was the loneliness that was really the harshest of all. And I thought, if I do not get a dog or something else to think about something other than myself and what I'm enduring, it's going to be too much. And the dog Diamond changed everything for me.
Well, this is an incredible story of perseverance. I want you to discuss what led you to the Alaskan wilderness and why.
Well, as most large endeavors, it's a series of events. Originally, after graduating from high school, my mother became sick with cancer and I became her caregiver, and that was an incredible lesson for me, especially because she worked so hard to get to retirement and would miss it by a year. And so I went traveling around the world, got the adventure bug, heard about a bunch of men and women skiing to the South Pole, and they were accepting applications, and ultimately I found my way on the team, and I didn't raise the $70,000 it was necessary in 10 months. So they went to the South Pole without me. And that at that point, I was quite young and stubborn and an Aries, so I decided to organize my own expedition, but not just to the South Pole, but all the way across Antarctica. So I organized this expedition and got the top outdoor women in the country on the team, Anne Bancroft, first woman to the North Pole with Will Steger, and top Himalayan climbers, Kelly Rhodes and Sue Giller. And at that time, I was about 24 years old, 25, and they all said about 10 months later, Renette, we've been doing this stuff for 15, 20 years, and you're just starting, and they kicked me off the team, and they went to the South Pole without me. So I was very depressed for a year, thinking, why bother dreaming? And then ultimately, after a year of depression, I came out of it saying, man, when I started this, I didn't even know how to ski, and I've come a long way. So why not just test myself? So I literally looked at the whole planet. I looked at Siberia, I looked at Greenland, and then I looked at Alaska, and I'd already been climbing Mount McKinley there, and I fell in love with it, and I thought, that's what I'll do. So I went up, and I actually commercial fished as a litmus test. I really thought, if I cannot commercial fish out in the Alaskan Gulf with a bunch of guys, then I certainly can't cross Alaska. So that was my own test. And by the time I got done with that, I was so wanting to get out in the middle of nowhere, away from humanity. It was the best thing I could have done. So it was a great setup. So, you know, all the doors closed when they needed to, and boy, the ones that needed to swing open when they needed to, they swung open.
Well, let's talk about that epic journey that you recount in your story. What was there a point where you thought, you know, this isn't going to happen. I'm not going to make it.
Well, the thing that was most shocking was that cold when it was 55 below.
And tell us how long this journey took.
It was 4 months, six days.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And 2 months of it was in an Athabascan village, a Stevens village. That's where I ultimately cut down the three trees and built the canoe. And originally I was going to ski across the whole entire state, and I got halfway across. And I was actually having a head-on collision with climate change. The Yukon ice on the river was completely thawing way ahead of schedule. And I thought, well, what do I do? I give up, or do I find a different way to continue? And so what was really harrowing was that the isolation and the extreme cold, and feel the difference, which I understand is you can't feel the difference between, let's say, 20 below and 55 below. But what happens is everything changes. The material of the tent shrinks and doesn't fit around the poles. When you extend the poles out to the tent, the elastic string in the center doesn't go back to its original, you know, size or shape. Eating becomes very difficult. Even trying to melt snow for water, there's very little moisture in the snow. You feel like you've been placed on a different planet. I mean, you feel like you've just landed on Mars. And it's a slap in the face. It's really quite jolting. So starting out, the snow is dry, sticking to the bottom of my skis, I found out that rivers don't freeze flat, they freeze concave. And so I had a choice of either going the dead center of the river, which is the oldest, thickest jumbled ice and very safe, but you're zigzagging around icebergs all day, or I had a straight shot on the side of the river. But again, it's concave, so it's like skiing sideways along a hill for hundreds and hundreds of miles. Well, that was my choice. So the sled, of course, was always kind of skewing me cockeyed as I was trying to ski, and that was very difficult. So the first few days was like, oh my God. And then ultimately I just got smart, and being a woman, I stuffed a bunch of Reese's peanut butter cups into my pockets and said, you get to that, you know, that bend in the river and you get another Reese's peanut butter cup. And once I got there, I'd say, okay, you get to that fallen tree way up there, you get another Reese's peanut butter cup, and I'd have 20 a day and on top of a 6,000 calorie a day diet. And, you know, I'd kind of coax myself as I went along.
Wow. Now, how often could you restock your supplies on that four-month journey? You mentioned the Athabascan village, but beyond that.
Well, fortunately, what happened was before I left, I was trying to think, okay, I have no money. I have no corporate sponsorship. This is as bare bones as you can go. I mean, I built my own sled, and I mean, you know, that was hauling, and it was just, when I left for my trip, I had about $15 in my pocket. So what I did before I left is I called each one of the little schools in the Athabascan villages and the Yupik Eskimo villages along the way, and I said to them, hey, I'm going to be skiing, you know, in your neck of the woods. Can I send you a box of resupplies? And I'd call these principals of these schools and say, if you will hold on to my box of supplies when I arrive, I'll be happy to talk to your school kids about my trip. And these schools are no bigger than 5 to 25 students.
Right.
So tiny.
Yeah.
And of course, all the principals said, yeah, I'll do that for you. And I said, just hold on to the box. I don't know how long it's going to take for me to get there, but just hold on to it. And I would arrive, and the first thing I'd say is, take me to your principal. They would. I have my box of resupplies right there, and I had more than I needed.
Well, that's a fantastic plan. That's really smart.
Budget. It's budget travel.
I'm David LaTulipe. I'm talking with Renette Senham, whose show Alaska Revisited is having a one-woman, one-performance-only performance this coming Saturday at 3 o'clock at the Delancey Street Foundation Screening Room. It's at 600 Embarcadero. You can go to brownpapertickets.com to look for that event details. Renette is one of the founders of Apple. Now, let me make a very clarification here. That particular Apple stands for Alliance for a Post-Petroleum Local Economy, dedicated to educating the community on the effects of oil depletion and global warming and the benefits of a strong local economy. Now, did your Alaska wilderness experience give you some special insight into helping developed communities?
Well, yes, actually, in many ways it did. First of all, the analogy of the river thawing out, the ice thawing out, and the only road that I knew was coming to an end. In many ways, I feel like that's what we're facing as a society. The only road we've known is coming to an end, and we have to change gears. We have to find a different way to continue, and we have to get creative. And ultimately, what I did was I pulled out the last Athabascan-built canoe in this village 20 years before. I pulled it out of an old snow berm next to my cabin door. And I looked at that canoe, and I thought, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to build myself a canoe. And the experience of building the canoe and how ultimately the Athabascans, you know, when I told them I was going to build it, they had to come back and tell me that women do not build canoes, you know, in their village. And I had to go back to the elders and say, oh, no, you don't understand. Where I come from in California, that's what women do. We're canoe builders. That's our thing. And they had no way to argue with that. They didn't know. So I had three Athabascan friends take me out into the woods with all the tools. I asked what kind of trees I cut down. I cut them down. I brought them back in. And when they discovered that I was really serious, they had a Herb and a big-bellied, toothless Athabascan have a fatherly talk with me, and he said, we call you Wonder Woman because of all the miles you can ski in a day, but you build this canoe, and we're gonna call you Fruitcake. So I start hand planing 5 days a week, 5 hours a day. I mean, they really think I'm crazy, and I'm just and these children had never seen a canoe built in their village. It has been 20 years, so a 10-year-old, a 15-year-old. They're like, what are you doing? I'm like, well, I'm building one of your canoes. And they come by, and, you know, and all the elders are going, Fruitcake, you know, and they'd wave, and the children would be going, Fruitcake, and they'd wave, you know. And ultimately, after 2.5 weeks of hand planing, I had all these 18-foot-long planks of wood I'd been submerging in the local muskrat pond, and I put them at my feet, and I had enough for two canoes. And this is where the most pivotal thing that happened to me on my journey was, that still influences me today in my community work, is they stopped coming by saying Fruitcake, and instead they started coming by saying, I got a sea clamp if you need a C-clamp for that. And someone else came by saying, I got some oil-based marine paint. You like blue and red?
It's kind of like the story of Stone Soup.
It really is. And I realize that you just have to start building things, even on a small, just get out there with your hands so people can see what you're talking about. And they'll want to be a part of that. But when you're just talking, sometimes talk is cheap and action is more.
Well, it takes a personality like yours as well, I believe. I believe just learning from you today that all you have to be told is no, and then it's from there you make it happen.
Well, yeah, actually, it's true. I mean, people say, how did you cross Alaska? I said, well, first of all, by the time I got to the banks of the frozen Yukon River, I was so ticked off by how many people tried to sabotage me and tell me no. It was incredible rocket fuel to launch me. But once I got into it, it wasn't until I was caring for my dog that I was like, of course I have to make it. I have a dog to care for. And that changed everything.
You're also co-founded a nonprofit organization called Power Up NC, dedicated to finding efficient energy programs and incentives for Nevada City, where you make your home, and other rural communities. Right. Could you tell us about that project?
Well, basically what we were doing is we realized there was a lot of solutions out there, and my objective was let's bring the solutions home and make Nevada City a model and teach people by example. So we did energy audits in all the city-owned buildings. We put solar on a lot of our different buildings. You know, we really kind of changed our ways. I started a Nevada City farmers market that was all based upon supporting local organic farmers and family farms, and you know, and really it's all about you know, being a model. We also did a peak oil task force where we created the a report basically on the short, mid, and long term effects of oil depletion or oil gas fuel interruptions, and we're only one of 13 cities in the world that has actually done that. So we're really trying to look at our future, like, okay, what happens if we have these interruptions? What happens if the price of oil goes up alone? And how do we deal with that? And ultimately, like the canoe, you're facing a challenge, but if you move around it, you'll be on the other side. Really in a place in your life you just didn't know you could reach, and doing things that you didn't know that you were capable of doing. And ultimately, I do believe that all the challenges we're seeing today's society is because our world is telling us that we can do better.
Well, considering my own and only Alaska adventure thus far was more of the Holland America cruise line variety.
Which is a nice
past
one.
October. my arms are going ave, ave to your spirit and the wonderful work, not only with smaller communities, but looking ahead to the next generation. It's really a wonderful thing.
Yeah, be a good ancestor, as they say, be a good ancestor.
Renette Senham, whose one-woman show, Alaska Revisited, once again, is at the Delancey Street Foundation Screening Room this coming Saturday, one performance only at 3 o'clock. Information at brownpapertickets.com. Renette, thank you so much for taking
thank
the time
today.
Thank
you so much, David.
From Alaska, we head south to Las Vegas.
You're the top. You're the Coliseum. You're the top. You're the Louvre Museum. You're a melody from a symphony by Strauss. You're a Bendelbaum and a Shakespeare sonnet. You're Mickey Mouse. You're the Nile. You're the Tower of Pisa. You're the smile on the Mona Lisa. I'm a worthless check, a total wreck, a flop. But if baby I'm a bottom, you're the top.
That's the voice of Clint Holmes, my next guest. And it's hard to believe that he's a three-time Las Vegas Entertainer of the Year, in addition to many other accolades, but is only now making his San Francisco debut in the fabulous new space that is the Raz Room at 1000 Van Ness. But there are firsts for everything, and let's hope this city makes a good impression on him. His show is called This Thing Called Love. Something tells me that Cole Porter classic is in the mix. We'll find out more momentarily. And it's currently running through this Sunday. Clint, welcome to San Francisco.
Thank you, Dave. Good to be here.
So what do you think of our fair city so far?
Well, I mean, I've never performed here before, but I come here every chance I get. They have wine here. And,
I've heard.
And yeah, and hills and food. It's beautiful. It's, you know, New York and San Francisco are my two favorite cities in this country. And so we come here as often as we can. But it is odd because I've been doing this a while. I'm an old guy, and I have never performed in San Francisco before. So that's fun.
Holding your age rather well, I should say.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
Well, your lineage is worth sharing with listeners. Born in England, the son of an African-American jazz musician and a classically trained white opera singer from Great Britain. That makes for quite a rich musical upbringing.
As I say in my show sometimes, I got the best of both worlds musically. My mom taught me how to sing correctly, and my dad taught me how to enjoy it. Because, you know, my mom started training me when I was probably 10 or 11, and my dad started taking me to hear jazz when I was 12. They had jam sessions at this club near Buffalo. We lived near Buffalo, New York, and Dad would take me in and to hear that. So I fell in love with jazz, but I also, you know, unknowingly and got trained. You know, not that I wanted to be trained, but now I get it. You know, thank God. So I got a rich heritage.
Well, speaking of New York State, I understand you went to Fredonia for a while.
Yeah, I did.
I was an Ithaca College grad.
Oh wow, okay, yeah, homeboys, also, Fredonia.
Also
I was a voice
program.
Major. They kicked me out after a year because I was already gigging. You know, so I would just miss all my morning classes. I'd go to Buffalo, I'd sing somewhere, and I'd get back and sleep. And the voice. The music people wanted me to stay in school, but the rest of the teachers said, "Who is he?" You know, because I never came to class. But it worked out well for me because I went into the Army music program, and I ended up singing in the United States Army Chorus at the White House. I spent in D.C. I spent my Army career, if you will, singing for presidents and stuff, and starting a real career in Washington. So I was fortunate. I was lucky.
How did you come into the Great American Songbook?
Huh. That's a great question because I missed it for a long time. You know, we do what we do, and all I've ever done is perform. You know, I mean, I've been lucky enough to make a living my whole life performing. And I had my record, My Name is Michael, I Got a Nickel, back in 1974. And that started me working, and I was doing what was contemporary then. Looking at the contemporary, James Taylor and Stevie Wonder and Paul Simon and the people that I loved. Somehow missing Cole Porter and George Gershwin and Harold Arlen and, you know, all of that. A couple of years ago, we got the opportunity, we being Jeff Nyman, my musical director, and I, to create a show at the Cafe Carlyle in New York City, where honoring Bobby Short, who was kind of the quintessential cabaret singer. His repertoire was the Great American Songbook. He was maybe the first exponent in terms of using it as a body of work.
Sure.
So suddenly there we were investigating Cole Porter and Harold Arlen and George Gershwin. And boy, there's a reason songs are classic, you know. And so it's only honestly been the past 2.5 years that's been a focal point of mine in terms of repertoire.
Well, you mentioned James Taylor and Paul Simon. That's the new Great American Songbook.
I say this,
sure.
Too. I love to say this, that people think of that. And I say the Great American Songbook is still being written. You know, Billy Joel, Stevie Wonder, Jimmy Webb, Bacharach, and David, you know, on and on, James Taylor. So, the show that we're doing at the Raz Room is a combination of music written by Cole Porter and Paul Simon, which was my goal, to find an old and a new. And I looked at different combinations of writers, Gershwin and Stevie, and this, you know, just to see. And those two writers, first of all, were poets, and second of all, were very much of their time. You know, Paul Simon was very much of Vietnam era and that time. Cole Porter was very much the gay, you know, 30s and 20s, you know. So, and then when we started to narrow down the material, it became clear that we'd have to narrow it down in some way. And so it became about love. What did Paul Simon and Cole Porter say about the subject of love? The good, the bad, and the ugly. I say in the beginning of the show, so Cole Porter and Paul Simon walk into a bar and they sit down. That's how the show starts. And they talk about love. And then it takes us on this journey of young love, passionate love, love that is uncertain, love that gets broken, and then searching for it. It didn't start out to be a play, but it almost ended up. It's one of my favorite shows I've ever done. I love it because it turns. You're sitting there and you're listening to I Concentrate on You and Loves Me Like a Rock and The Lovely and Feeling Groovy, and it's very lovely and the show's nice. And then suddenly this guy is unhappy and cheats on his wife. And then has to deal with that, and has to deal with the fact that he knows he screwed up his life and lost his love, and where does that leave him? And it's just a very interesting show. So.
That's fascinating. And one of the trademarks of your performances is that you don't always keep the same set of music. You keep things liquid.
Mm-hmm.
So is this more of a set performance?
This is, yes.
You've selected certain numbers of this Paul Simon, Cole Porter.
This is
created a story around
it. Created a story. Again, it didn't start that way, but it just kind of took that turn. So, yeah, but the beauty of it is the music is so diverse because it's from different eras. And Jeff Nyman, my musical director, is such a wonderful arranger in the sense that he finds twists and turns that make sense musically and thematically, which is cool too. So I don't get bored with it, is my point. Sometimes I get, I want to, hey, let's do this tonight. This show, I don't get that feeling. I love doing this show.
Mm-hmm. Who else is backing you up in your band?
I brought two of our friends from Las Vegas, actually. Jess Gopin is our drummer and Bob Sachs is our bassist. They're great players, and they knew the show because we've done it at home and in New York, and so I brought them in.
Vegas is your home now, though, in terms of you do most of your performances there. You're evolving as a singer in your third or fourth decade of doing this. It's wonderful that things keep evolving.
You know what? Growing is what it's all about. When you stop growing, you start dying, as far as I'm concerned. So for me, investigating new music, even if it's old music, is exciting. I was at 7 years, I was at Harrah's in Las Vegas, and I was doing six shows a week, 48 weeks a year.
Wow.
And I had an amazing 12-piece band. It was phenomenal. But then it started to feel like here I am and here I'm going to be. And there are still things I want to do. Theater. I'm working on a theater piece right now. I want to record. I want to do a complete jazz-driven album. I mean, there's things I want to do. And so the last couple of years have been spent breaking new ground musically and also being here in San Francisco. This is a great city. And hopefully we'll make enough of an impression that we'll get to come back.
What took you so long to get out here?
I couldn't find it. I kept getting stuck in Sausalito, and
if you took the cab that you took to the station, I can understand couldn't find San Francisco. Anyway, let me back up a little bit. You talked about your earlier days in New York and then singing in Washington. I didn't realize you also spent some time as announcer as well for the then new Late Show starring Joan Rivers back in 86 on the then new Fox Network.
I did. I was her announcer. I was opening for Joan on the road in those days in Atlantic City, and she was putting the show together. And one night we were in Atlantic City, and she said, "I'm still looking for an announcer." And I said, "Joan Rivers." And she said, "Okay." And it was a little more complicated than
that,
but that's how it happened. And so I spent a year. It was a great experience. There's a lot of unfortunate energy around that show.
That's too bad.
Because we all worked hard, and Joan was great. I love her very much. But you know what? It opened other doors for me.
Right.
Then I did Entertainment Tonight for 2 years. I was a music correspondent on Entertainment Tonight because of them seeing me on the Joan Rivers show, because Joan would get me on camera as often as she could. So it was like everything else, a step.
I wanted to also thank you for being a spokesman for the American Cancer Society, encouraging people over the age of 50 to get a colonoscopy, because I understand you had a bout with colon cancer yourself.
Yeah. I was one of the real lucky ones. In a routine physical, they found it, and it was early, and they got rid of it. But my doctor afterwards said to me, if you're willing to talk about this on stage, it'll help, because, people look at an entertainer and they go, "That guy doesn't have a problem in the world." Well, hello, So I started to actually kind of wrote a little piece about it, I have actually had people come to me and say, "I saw your show. I went home and got a colonoscopy, and I was lucky they found it early." And da da da. So, it's an easy way to help. So if it's been helpful, great. But it's an important issue, because we don't want to do that. Why? We don't want to get a colonoscopy. Who the heck wants to do that? But it's necessary.
Yeah. Well, I hope you have an excuse to come back to San Francisco. You're in the new Raz room at its new location.
Yeah.
So I hope that's a nice venue for you. And it entices you to come back.
Never saw the old one.
Right.
Jack Jones, who's a buddy of mine, called me and said, "What's it like? What's it like?" I said, "I don't know. It's nice. It's lovely. I got to see the old one." It is. The sound is great. The people are very nice. I like the room a lot. So, yeah, I hope I get to come back, too.
I hope to catch the show. Clint Holmes, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Dave.
The show is called This Thing Called Love. It's at the Raz Room, the new Raz Room, 1000 Van Ness Avenue in San Francisco. It's already open, but it is running through Sunday. Tomorrow's show is, tonight at 8, tomorrow and Saturday at 7, and closes Sunday at 5. Do catch Clint Holmes at the Raz Room. This Thing Called Love. Here's some more music of Clint Holmes.
I saw my old lover on the street last night. She seemed so glad to see me. We just smiled. So we talked about some old times. and we drink ourselves some beers. Still crazy after all these years. Ooh, still crazy after all these years. I'm not the kind of a man who tends to socialize. No, I seem to lean on old familiar ways. And I ain't no fool for love songs, someone whispers in my ears. Still crazy after all these years. Oh, still crazy after all these years. Oh, in the morning, crapped out, yawning, longing my life away. That it's all gonna fade. So now I sit by my window and I watch the cars. I fear I'll do some damage one fine day. But I would not be convicted by a jury of my peers. Oh, still crazy after all of these years. I'm still crazy. After all, after all these years.
Singer Clint Holmes, who is at the Raz Room tonight at 8, tomorrow and Saturday at 7, and Sunday for a final performance at 5 p.m. His show is called This Thing Called Love, combining the music of Paul Simon, who we just heard him sing, along with some Cole Porter and some very entertaining banter in between. Clint Holmes at the Raz Room, 1000 Van Ness. More information at live@theraz.com. That's live at the Raz, two R's, two Z's on that, .com. I'm David Latulippe, and you've been listening to Open Air. Here's just a couple of things that are happening in the days ahead that you might be interested. At St. Stephen's Church in Belvedere, tomorrow at 7:30, Bach's St. John Passion is going to be performed. And as a little treat for you, here's a prelude for this coming Monday's concert that features this very work, Johann Sebastian Bach's Sonata in B Minor for Flute. We're going to hear Robert Stallman conclude our hour together. You'll hear Carol Wincents perform that Monday at Temple Emmanuel as part of the Music at Meyer series. Here's music of Johann Sebastian Bach to conclude Open Air for this week. Thanks for listening. Thank you. final movement of the Sonata in B Minor, BWV 1030, performed by Robert Stallman on the flute with Edwin Swanborn, harpsichord. It's from a new release on the Bogner's Cafe label. Robert Stallman will be my guest next month on an edition of Open Air. Thanks for listening to Open Air this week. Thanks once again to Neil Swinkels and Jerry Jones for both of their invaluable assistance in making today's show possible.